Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, January 6, 2011. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, our year in review. This is a time that I like to look back and say, what happened over the last year? We're looking for the deeper news, and particularly those events and trends that are important to what's happening going forward in 2011. Now, it's interesting. This is not just the end of a year, but it's the end of a decade. In fact, the first decade of the 20th century. And it's interesting to think about how much has happened. For many of us, the world looked very different when we started this decade. Part of it was we were in a bubble. I remember I have an acquaintance who'd been very successful on Wall Street, gone to a top Ivy League school, and I remember her saying, right at the turn of the century, why would anybody care about the Popsicle Index, which is my index for the safety of children in a community, and it's sort of a rule of thumb for the well-being in a community. And she said, I don't understand. I don't get that. I don't understand why anybody would care about it. And towards the end of the decade, she came to me and apologized and said, you know, now I understand. Safety and the sense of civilization has changed very differently because many of the things we took for granted, well, all bets are off. We don't have the bubble and the bubble income protecting us from facing the deeper trends. We started the decade with computers and courts picking the new U.S. president and then 9/11 paving the way for a major global military expansion around the globe, including wars in Eurasia, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan in particular. One of the reasons we continue to hear and see so much effort to bring transparency to the events of 9/11 was it was such an important pivot in terms of swinging the global legal, financial, and military policies. And those changes in combination, as we can see play out through the decade, have had a dramatic impact on the governance systems on planet Earth and really the creation of a permanent global war economy marked by day-to-day control that's exercised by banks and corporations rather than sovereign governments. What we've watched during this period is an explosion of derivatives and financial fraud. It's really the full blossoming of a profound separation of the financial economy from the real economy. And this, the whole process came to a fore with the failure of Lehman Brothers and the bailouts when people around the world who just assumed that the central banks made good, would make good, discovered that they wouldn't always and that the value of their assets was subject to this great game of economic warfare going on around the planet. What has happened during that period, during it was really the 90s and up through the bailouts, was that as an economic matter, the equivalent of the entire retirement savings of a generation of baby boomers in Europe and North America literally has been shifted out of government, out of institutions, and into a select group of private interests. Now, the manner in which this is done has been complex, but the essence of it is simple, and that picture is starting to emerge. We called the 2010 the year of the road shifts eastward, and that's because a lot of that money was reinvested in the emerging markets with an enormous concentration on Asia. We've seen two decades of big financial bets on Asia by capital coming out of Europe and North America. And as a result, we're starting to see the real shift in economic power move in a way that in 2010 became apparent. A lot of people in North America had not understood what the World Trade Organization and the trade agreements of the 90s was going to mean to the middle class in the first world. And a lot of the response we're seeing from the Tea Party movement and different sort of anger at the grassroots really reflects now the fact that that is becoming apparent. 2010 was also a period when we saw the G20 leadership outside of the G8, the BRIC nations really flex their muscle vis-a-vis the United States, and real expression globally of the frustration of being called on to finance the U.S. military and global empire through the mechanism of the currency and sovereign debt. We heard a word a lot in 2010 that we're going to hear a lot in 2011, and that was rebalancing. It's sort of a nice word to tell the U.S. consumer that the corporate infrastructure can replace first world labor and consumers with emerging market labor and consumers. And that's what's happening. As a result, the unemployment is growing, and it's growing worldwide, and it is fundamentally shifting the relationship between labor and capital, which is one of the deeper trends going on. A great quote we had up on the blog this year from Larry Lindsay, former governor of the Federal Reserve, booted out with the Secretary of Treasury from the second Bush administration. He said in September, quote, "The main economic policy of the administrations," meaning both Clinton and Bush, "has been subsidies for capital and not for labor." And that's a fact. What the bailouts have been is a tremendous subsidy for capital and not for labor. And what the trade organization agreements have done is the same thing. They've completely re-engineered the rules between capital and labor. And the emerging markets, particularly Asia, have flowered in no small part thanks to some of those developments. At the same time, as we move the money, we also move the military to protect those investments. And so not surprisingly, given the boom, it is not surprising we see major action and competition for resources globally, but particularly in Eurasia, where if our money is going to trend eastward, then the military is going to trend eastward to protect it. Okay, so let's look at the top trends and events of 2010. I'm going to go through 14 trends and events that define 2010, and I think are critical to understand to understand what's going to be happening in this year. Number one is it's the economy, stupid. Economy. Economy has been on everybody's mind. New poll survey from Rasmussen of likely U.S. voters shows the economy is listed as the most important issue, very important, by 87%. That's up 82% just from October. As predicted in last year's wrap-up, the slow burn continued and unemployment grew. Expect all of those to continue in 2011. The economy is going to be on the top of everybody's concerns, and it's not going to be this is not going to be an issue that's going to be simple or easy. It's going to be a major topic of discussion, and it's not going to go away. Number two, I call financial coup d'etat, hey ho, the status quo. What came out in full force in 2010 is that literally after all the financial fraud and corruption that was brought to the fore in 2008 and 2009 by the takedown and ending of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, by massive losses by investors, fraudulent paper, it was clear that the mortgage bubble had involved great deals of fraud, the Fed and the Treasury literally papered over the problems, shifted all the losses to the taxpayers, then some $12 trillion in bailouts. And what happened? There were essentially no indictments, no meaningful recaptures. We're going to see this, we're seeing in 2010 record bonuses for Wall Street. And the game goes on. And as I said, after Iran-Contra, crime that pays is crime that stays, and what we're watching is crime that paid and is continuing. We saw in 2010, we saw the development of what everybody now knows as a flash crash. Speculation by Max Kaiser and others that Wall Street had blackmailed Washington in the middle of the final round of negotiations on the financial reform bill. Wouldn't surprise me if that's true. the financial reform bill ended up with no real teeth, just scores of make work for a lot of financial institutions, big and small, as well as plenty of companies, big and small. But Flash Crash left a very bad taste in the investors' mind because ultimately financial markets depend on the rule of law, and you're left, you know, you're left with a real feeling of a lawless situation. The foreclosure fraud and servicing fraud turned out to be the new game on housing, even after the Fed and Treasury basically took the banks out in an amount greater than 100% of all the residential mortgages in the country. That wasn't enough. The banks and their servicers continued to engage in significant foreclosure fraud, a big story in the fourth quarter. So again, we see the financial coup d'etat continuing and the financial fraud as a major business continuing. One of the most prescient comments of the year in a major trial balloon with Bill Clinton when asked what he thought of the efforts by the SEC to enforce against Goldman Sachs, who got off, I would say, with a tiny slap on the wrist, given the real issues at hand, was that the problem with Goldman deals was not that they were illegal, and he didn't address whether they were or not, but that much time and money and talent had gone into doing something that had added absolutely no value to the real economy. And then pointed out that a lot of this was happening because we'd gotten away from a gold standard, which I thought was quite a trial balloon. But the comment is right. We are supporting an enormous and very expensive financial sector that is not adding to the real economy. In fact, one of the biggest tensions this year in the G20 was we have real economies, growing economies, Brazil, a perfect example, that need currencies and different financial arrangements to trade and conduct a real economy. And their efforts to conduct a real economy are being hamstrung and hiccuped by the desire of a variety of financial speculators to use those vehicles for financial speculation and economic warfare. And so there's a real tension ultimately that impacts every nation and every institution, and that is our financial system designed to engage in basically running a lotto and engaging in warfare, or is it designed to facilitate markets and trade? And so far, the speculation and the economic warfare is winning. A third trend: tangibles explode. You've often heard from me a favorite quote I heard Jimmy Rogers say down at the New Orleans Gold Conference once a year. Somebody asked him if he was worried about peak oil, and he looked at them with his little pink bow tie and said, "Forget peak oil, it's peak everything." Well, what we saw this year as the central banks and the Federal Reserve engaged in another round of quantitative easing and tremendous debasement of the currencies, we saw an explosion in the price of tangibles that really delivered that message that we're in peak oil and bubble economics. We're in peak everything, and bubble economics is not going to paper it over. We saw silver and gold price up 83.5% and 29.5% respectively. If you look at the price of gold and silver in hundreds of currencies around the globe, it's the same story over and over again. The 83%, 29% is in the dollar, but if you look at any one of those hundreds of currencies, what you're seeing is this is a global movement, and it's against all paper currencies. An even bigger explosion came in agricultural commodities. We saw cotton, soybean up tremendously, in combination with the efforts to control the food supply, it's painting a very serious picture worldwide for people around the world, because the price of food has obviously a profound impact on quality of life everywhere. And we're going to talk about more about that when we get to food. A lot of what we saw, the action we saw in gold, I would say supports my contention for, in fact, since the year 2000, that the suppression of the gold price has been part of a process of privatizing gold stores on the way to returning to a system with gold at the heart of it for a new global currency system. I had one of you up on the teleseminar software, again, you can post questions, said, could the drop in the gold price be a last-ditch attached to discredit gold? I don't think so. I had predicted that gold would end the year at 1350. It ended the year slightly above 1400. I had said 1350 because I thought the central banks would hold it to 25%. Instead, they appear to have held the line at 30%. I think there is a desire to see gold rise, but in a managed process. And so they're letting gold rise, but they're trying to keep it from accelerating too much. What's interesting is if you watch the patterns of up and consolidation in the precious metals market over the last 10 years, what we're seeing is a much more broad-based market. It's a much deeper market. There are a lot more players. You have interest around the globe, and that's the basis of a more significant global long-term bull market, which is what Franklin Sanders and I have talked about on the Solari Report all year long. We had an interesting blog post by Paul Ferguson of Solari Silver and Gold. He's noticing the same thing happen in the junior miners, and watching when the Canadian markets weren't trading, watching significantly more volume in the junior miners, again indicating much more global depth and interest in precious metals. So no, I don't think the price drop is a last ditch effort. I think the powers that be anticipate a rising gold price, but they want to manage process, and they understand that there's a lot more they can do with soaking out fiat currency. There's a lot more value to be gathered there. We did 12 precious metals market reports in the Solari Report in 2010 with Franklin Sanders. We had James Turk on as well. We expect to do the same next year. Precious metals, we think, is at the heart of repositioning your assets, and it's going to be at the heart of what happens with the currency system. So it's important to us. We also did 3 special reports, one on the gold and silver ETFs, one on storage options. When we tell people to make sure they stay out of the ETFs, we wanted to make sure they had plenty of options at their fingertips. And finally, we did a special report on the U.S. tax issues for moving positions from unallocated to allocated positions, something that's happening more and more as people are worried about the integrity of their depository arrangements. I made a bet with one of the investment advisors I work with on the S&P 500 and the long bond and precious metals. He won the precious metals. I was too low. And to my amazement, I won the long bond and the S&P 500. But both because they reflected my belief in the slow burn. Compared to tangibles, the S&P 500 and the 30-year bond were up 12.9% or had investment returns of 12.9% and 5.6%. But a deeper look, those can be misleading. A deeper look at the securities market continues to reflect that shift of capital investment returns to the emerging markets and eastward. Gold looks great until you compare it to the Indonesian stock market, and then you're reminded that significant enterprise and making real things, of course, adds more economic value than putting metal in a vault. So expect this year more big split in stock market performance between those areas that reflect aging demographics and those that reflect young populations. Trend number 4, the weather gets weirder. Nothing is more frustrating than trying to get accurate information about what's happening to the climate and weather on our planet and around it in the solar system. Whether it's our weather is being impacted by our rotation through the galaxy or by man-made influences, whether it's environmental damage and stress or weather control and weaponry, there's no doubt we're dealing with unusual and unpredictable weather, and it's causing uncertainty in our lives and in the economy. We did a series this year on chemtrails, 3 of them, in fact, on chemtrails and 1 on HAARP, to educate you about the issues of geophysical engineering and the possibility of weather warfare. We're going to do more on that in 2011 because I think weather, unusual weather patterns is something that's going to impact us all, and that's going to be from everything from, if you know, for me it's been roof repairs, power outages, and the price of food. You know, for those who lived in New Orleans, it was something much more dramatic. But it's going to thread throughout every part of our life in the economy. I should mention, you know, it was funny that I called 2010 the road turns eastward. National Geographic just published an article that I put up on the blog saying that the Earth's north magnetic pole is shifting from Canada to Russia at the speed of 40 miles a year. So just as the investment capital is moving, so is the north magnetic pole, and you sort of wonder, I wonder what the connection is. There has to be one. Number five, the Gulf oil spill. I think the Gulf oil spill was the big surprise in 2010. It was a devastating blow to the southern states. It was a devastating blow to their extraordinary life and environmental resources, not to mention one of the richest sources of economic animal protein in the world. One of the things I try and remind the people who promote the idea of collapse scenarios is that every year the Earth just gives forward a huge harvest. If you live in a farming community, you really begin to realize that the extraordinary nature and the bountifulness of the gift of harvest every year, and the harvest of fish and wildlife in the Gulf is incredible. And to lose that source of literally free and bountiful animal protein, and one harvested by thousands and thousands of small entrepreneurs, is just has frightening implications to the North America food supply and the global food supply. We did a Soleri report on the manipulation of the oil markets right before the Gulf oil spill, with Jim Norman, whose book, The Oil Card, if you haven't read, it's really one of the best, you know, it's one of the contenders for best 10 books to help you understand the 21st century. We had him back after the spill to talk about what was happening in the Gulf, and then had Ricky Ott, who was the fisherman in Valdez, who became a leader of the local response to the Exxon Valdez spill and was part of the litigation against Exxon for years. And so when the spill happened, went to the Gulf to teach them what she had learned and to help out. I said at the time that I thought the explosion, I gave it a 70% chance of being intentional. The more information that emerges, the stronger the circumstantial evidence is to support a covert operation causing the spill, including a need to shut down significant supply coming from the Gulf if we were going to keep oil and gas prices high this year. Again, as we described in our interview with Jim Norman, critical in terms of checkmating China's power and managing Russia. And so there's a deeper and more complex story, if I'm right. The management of the spill was almost as disturbing as the spill itself. We watched BP stock plummet. We saw, to the first time I've ever noticed, a corporation declare a dividend and then cancel it. And then we saw, and I believe it was contiguous with the Bohemian Grove, literally the powers that be say, shut this thing down, we can't afford this. And I suspect it was not just because the BP was going to go under and wipe the shareholders out, and given who some of those shareholders are, we're talking about very significant financial interests. But in addition, it meant very serious ramifications for the bond market and the related derivative markets, both in fixed income and in oil and gas. And so I think it was fear of what could happen in the derivative markets and what that could, the ripple effect that got it shut down and had everyone suddenly saying in an Orwellian manner, everything is now fine and the Gulf is fine and life in the Gulf is fine and the economy is fine and the ocean's fine. And so we're left with this horrible feeling yet again of we could spend an enormous amount of time trying to get a handle on what's really happening and still not know, but it's not good, it's serious, and I think the ramifications are going to be are going to be with us for a long time. Trend number six, I call it an invasive combo, technology and regulation. We spent a lot of time talking in 2010 about invasive technology and how to protect yourself against it. We had Bob Sullivan, the top reporter in the country on identity theft, and then Catherine Albrecht, a real leader on invasive spy chip technology. Great book, Spy Chips, and talked about sort of how you protect yourself from that kind of sort of invasive technology. We wrote two special reports in response to your questions on the census, both what it was and then what the risks of enforcement, you know, if you decide not to respond to the census, what were the enforcement issues. We also covered a lot about the healthcare databases and efforts to build a national healthcare database in connection with our coverage of the healthcare bill. Whether it's the government listening on your phones or through the internet or strangers stealing your digital identity, we are in or entering a world in which there is zero privacy. And this is a time to be peccable with your compliance. You assume that everything you do and say is known and understood. There are no secrets. That's on the negative side. On the positive, WikiLeaks was a reminder of the power of transparency and what the internet can do, whether WikiLeaks was a grassroots effort or even used by various factions dishing out on each other. Those kind of transparency leaking and warfare by various factions ultimately can also have a healthy effect. We saw the interesting WikiLeaks impact. We saw Hillary Clinton being floated as the name to replace Gates at Department of Defense. We had Newt Gingrich saying, oh, I think Hillary Clinton would make a great Secretary of Department of Defense. Suddenly WikiLeaks hits, reams Clinton in an extraordinary and unbelievable way, who then announces that this is her last position in government. She's not running for president and is going back to the private sector to help with children. So don't be surprised to see more efforts to control the internet in 2011. One of the great aha moments on the Solari Report in 2010 was Nora Gagaudis from Oregon talking about her efforts as a neurofeedback practitioner, having to train people at lower and lower levels because something is causing them, no matter whether they live in rural areas, urban areas, suburban areas, something is causing them to be jacked up in a permanent state of fight or flight mode. And while she can't say what's causing it, we all suspect electromagnetic pollution. We talked a little bit about chemtrails and HARP, but there's a lot more we want to talk about in 2011 because I think protecting ourselves from that kind of electromagnetic pollution is going to be, and coping with it is something that's going to be important. Trend number seven, disaster capitalism and the Haiti earthquake. I have to mention the earthquake in Haiti as one of the most memorable events of the year, both because of the heartbreaking death and suffering, as well as the glaring example of disaster capitalism. If you haven't read Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, I encourage you to do so. We can't change the predatory economic model until we can see it, and Klein's done an enormous service for all of us by helping us see it in all the different parts. Needless to say, the retail stores, I was amazed. They were waiting to take donations for the Haiti earthquake in a frighteningly brief time. And I would remind you in 2011, because this is going to happen again. Don't fall for it. Only give to the people you know and trust, and don't give to foundations which are fronted by former presidents. The chances are you'll be financing more disaster capitalism, and again, expect it to happen in 2011. It's one of the ways they keep the slow burn continuing when you need to enrich yourself with new natural resources and other resources. You just steal them. Number eight, sovereign debt and debased dollars. We're going to see two things happen in the sovereign debt world. It's going to be a combination of hot potato and then kick the can. As the cash flows shrink, and let me step back, we are going through a period, this is all part of financial coup d'etat, where assets are being moved out of communities and governments into corporations at below market prices. So corporations are getting a backdoor windfall, and liabilities are getting moved back into government without government being adequately compensated to take them on. And in addition, governments issue more and more debt, and that money tends to pour into sort of keeping the game going and pouring more money into corporations. And it is through these various mechanisms that the shift in control and power between corporations, and I would include in that banks and governments, is happening. Now, what this leaves is a government sector, sovereign governments around the world, and in the United States, the states, that have enormous debt loads, and as the bubble wears off, the incomes are dropping, and that debt becomes harder and harder and more expensive to carry. And it's not just the debt; it's in the United States and in Europe, it's the contingent liabilities, particularly for the retirement benefits for the aging population. Added to this debt game is the global frustration with the fact that the U.S. dollar is in essence a taxation system, and U.S. Treasury's debt is a taxation system to fund the military. We're basically amortizing our military expenses around the world. People take dollars or Treasury bills, and then they go down in value as a result of the debasement. And that is essentially what's financing the military that is then, so everybody's financing the military that's got a gun pointed at their head, making them buy more dollars and treasuries. Now, for many years now, we've had a long-term bond market bull market, and it's drawing to the close as we now sit with up to our eyeballs in debt, and everybody trying to figure out as the cash flows drop, where's the hot potato going to go next? Because as the cash flows drop, suddenly you have a situation where the debt can't be serviced, and then you've got to work out or do something, and that's where the kick the can comes in, because the workout's usually, rather than facing the fundamental issues, everybody gets together, prints more money, and kicks the cans. Now, central banks can debase the currency, and so that means the shift from a bull market in the bond market to the bull market in the tangibles and equities. So a lot of what we saw in tangibles and equities was not a rise in their value per se. It was just a fall in the value of paper currencies. In 2011, what we're going to see is a real question of winners and losers around the globe. Who's going to win at this hot potato kick the can game in terms of governments? Part of the issue is that the debt system is really not a financial system at this point. It's a control system by which a few outsiders can control, through the dependency on debt, the governments as they get weaker and weaker. In the United States, the big issue is going to be state and local government. We saw Meredith Whitney late last year predict a lot of bankruptcies in the state and local government. Joe Mizak at Bloomberg came out and said, no, she's being too aggressive. In fact, state and local governments aren't going to default on the bonds. What they're going to protect the bondholders. What they're going to do is they're going to default or reengineer their labor deal and their pension benefits. But that's the question. Whose ox is going to get gored? Is it going to be bondholders? Is it going to be pension beneficiaries? Is it going to be labor? Is it going to be the taxpayers, or is it going to be all of the above? What's going to come up in the sort of issues of state and local government struggle with this is 10th Amendment issues. A lot of the expenses at the state and local level reflect mandates from the federal government or things the federal government is doing that make life infinitely more expensive, both for the households, for the communities, for the counties, for the states, the 10th Amendment issues are going to come up, the county enforcement issues are going to come up. That's why we had a Solari report on who's your sheriff, because many people 2 years ago did not really understand what their local sheriff did or why he was important to them. In fact, what they're going to discover is real leadership in your local sheriff and your local officials is going to make an enormous difference during this period. But the state and local issues are going to cause a lot of tension, and one of the other issues that will bring to the fore is why can the federal government why can the central bank for the federal government just print paper? Why can't the states? We saw in California, when California tried to issue script to deal with a budget, J.P. Morgan Chase and the big banks refused to take it, and then basically held the state over the barrel and said, okay, we'll give you a loan. What they're saying is, we won't let you finance yourself, but we will finance you. You have to pay us essentially a toll booth fee to get financing. Well, the reality is California can finance on itself, on its own credit. It doesn't need the banks. It needs the banks to transact. But that fundamental of issue of why should the banks control the currency, which they do through the Federal Reserve, and why can't the states, is going to come up. Issue number 9, or trend number 9, the Obama myth evolves. The low point of my year in 2008 was listening to Joan Baez and Caroline Casey on Caroline's radio show compare Barack Obama to John F. Kennedy. One of the reasons, if I didn't believe in entrainment and subliminal programming after the Obama election, I take it back, it wasn't 2008. It wasn't 2008. That certainly... the extent to which we developed incredible fantasies about the extent to which one president of the United States could re-engineer a 500-year-old investment model against the wishes of the most powerful interests of the world, and without inconveniencing the average person or their cash flows. I mean, to say that it was a fantasy is to be kind, and yet it was one that seemed to capture our imagination. And what we've seen in 2009, with the sort of the year of the vampire squid, is it beginning to dawn on people with $12 trillion of bailouts that was not something that Barack Obama could do, and this was a deeper change and a deeper struggle. What we saw in 2010 with the health care bill, was passed with the majority of people in the country being opposed to its passage, not to say that different provisions didn't have support, but we now see 60% of the country wanting repeal, and the sort of invasive technology and the pleasing of drug insurance company issues as opposed to what people basically need was very evident. If anything, the health care bill cost the Democrats the House in the 2010 election. And yet, it is amazing to see how popular Obama continues to be in many parts of the population. My prediction is he's going to win the election in 2012, but the 2012 election will begin in 2011. It's going to be with us for a long time. If you look at how much Obama has done for the pro-centralization team and the extent to which he's delivered everything that the banks wanted and can dreamed of, I can't fathom why they would let another candidate in. This guy has put an attractive and intelligent face on some of the worst centralization, that not only have we ever seen, but can fathom. So at the same time, what we're watching, I think, and which is hopeful, is as he continues to engineer the process for the pro-centralization team, many of us are beginning to face the need for a much deeper change and understanding the fact that the president literally cannot deliver it alone. Number 10, if I had to say that there was one trend that I think is the most important, this would be it. More important, in fact, than the economy, because it's one of the drivers of the economy. And that is what I call food fascism. Food freedom, the freedom to grow and your food, the freedom to have good, high-quality, fresh food is the basis of freedom. If a small group of people can control food, it literally is the end of freedom. What we saw in 2010 was a very dramatic accomplishments in the area of asserting global control of the seed supply, the water supply, the food supply, and it continues to support my contention that food is the candidate to replace oil as the asset behind a new global currency. You can't have a powerful fiat currency without controlling the trade in tangibles. For the dollar, it's been oil. The question is, what is it going to be for a new global currency? Yes, gold can be a store of value. We could have a gold standard behind the SDR system at the IMF level. But for control and to enforce that currency and the use of that currency, you need something that replaces oil. And I think it's food, and that I think that explains one of the reasons we're seeing the extraordinary efforts to control and debase the food supply. Price rises are a part of that, but also, as I mentioned, the Gulf oil spill, the WTO efforts continue with GATT, with the Doha round, to engineer agriculture into an industrial model globally. We're seeing corporations buying up water and farmland around the world. The food safety bill has happened in the United States. And finally, we see many more rumblings of Codex rearing its head internationally and in a way that could come to the United States. So one of the things we're going to be doing in 2011 is talking about Codex. Ensuring that you have a high-quality, fresh food supply. There's nothing more important than continual reports on genetically modified food and what it can do to sterilize the second generation or to literally weaken our minds and bodies are absolutely chilling. So if you haven't focused on how you're going to make sure you provide an excellent food supply on an economic basis to your family, this is something we spent a lot of time on in the Solari Report in 2010 and 2009, but, you know, we're going to be doing it again in 2011. Number 11, war in Eurasia. The war in Afghanistan and Iraq continue. Expect the military presence in Eurasia is really a permanent presence. If you look at the competition for resources globally, the shift eastward of the investment, it means the military has to shift to enforce. Nobody puts money where they can't enforce. And that means as the money moves globally, so the military must. It's simply the nature of the investment model. Number 12, aging in North America and Europe, the exit game cometh. 10,000 Americans turn 65 every day. Same dynamic going on in Europe. This is going to have a profound impact on every aspect of our life. It's going to have a profound impact on the deficit because as those Americans retire, they're going to be drawing on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And what we're watching in the federal budget, what you see in the U.S. debt clock, is you've got the interest on the national debt, you have the military, and then you have Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and in combination, they're a pig trying to go through a snake. There was in 2009, we talked about the documentary Maxed Out, wonderful documentary about the consumer debt problems in America. Elizabeth Warren gave an interview and spoke about how she had tried to talk with congressmen about what we were going to do to provide for retirements and basic social services for the middle class as the savings was dropping and we had these various financial problems and the debt was rising. And she describes them all sort of smiling and walking away and realizing that there is no exit game, there is no plan. That's kind of roll off the cliff. And the reality is we're here now, because if you look at the numbers that are retiring, it's here. This also has profound implications for the culture, because people, as they age, need more services. They have a different point of view. So this is going to be an issue that gets more and more important in 2011, more important for some time to come. Number 13, space. I call that the breakaway civilization and the final frontier. One of the best books you could read, again, for the 21st century, is Richard Dolan's book on the national security state. We had an interview with Richard in the Salieri Report in 2010. If you haven't heard it, I really recommend you go back and into the archives. It's his second book on the national security state. It's UFOs and the national security state. It's very long, and I said to somebody the other day, you know, it's almost more important to read the first and the last chapter 10 times than to read the book, because he does a remarkable job of describing what has happened in America, which is you have a small group of people, and he termed it the breakaway civilization. You have a small group of people who, by the various covert means that we've discussed on the Salieri Report over the last 2 years, by these covert means have financed a whole new generation of technology and weaponry, a lot of it invisible weaponry, and they literally have stolen so much money and have gathered so many resources that they have become a breakaway civilization. They don't feel obligated to socialize with us. They don't feel obligated to follow the laws of any particular sovereign government. They are a civilization unto their own, and they have the money and power to back it up. And one of the wild cards that we're looking at for 2011 is, what is the breakaway civilization going to be up to? I continue to believe that a significant amount of money is not just going eastward and into Asia, but is going into space. Space is the final frontier. Space has all sorts of opportunities for mining, for colonization. I think we're making very, very big bets on space, but increasingly they're corporate investments, even though government is and taxpayers are paying for it. Equally frustrating to our situation with the weather is trying to get information on all of this, but expect to see continual more discussion in 2011 as things change. More and more people, I think, are going to be asking questions. And finally, the last trend, number 14, vertical charts call for a new story. If you look at charts on unemployment, if you look at a variety of different charts, graphics that show you or try and describe economic or different phenomena in our society, what we're seeing is we're not just in another recession. We're not just in another depression. We're not just in another cycle of the industrial economy. In fact, we are leaving the paradigm that we've been in since World War II, and we're going into something new. We're not just coming out of a down cycle. We're in a whole new story, and I think as people look at those charts, particularly the unemployment chart, they're starting to begin to say, you know, I need to start thinking about, I need to make other plans. And so I think 2011 is going to be a year where those discussions are happening more and more, as you know, whether it's the weather or the official explanations. We saw stories over the last week about about birds in Arkansas, Kentucky, and other places around the world. Suddenly flocks of birds, thousands of birds dying at once, inexplicably. We got an official explanation that it was the sounds coming from the fireworks on, at the New Year. Of course, you look at that explanation, you think, now that's really strange. So as the weirdness increases, we're going to see more and more people looking and saying, you know, we can't wait for a new president. We're going to have to write a new story. Predictions, 2010, how did I do? I said there was 70% chance of a slow burn, 20 to 25% of another 2008 sort of serious hiccup, and about 0 to 5% collapse. It was interesting. I spent a lot of time in 2010, both with clients and subscribers, having to beat back fears about collapse. It was funny. A lot more people were more afraid of collapse than debasement, and yet, you know, the being drained by debasement and the inflation and the slow inflation or the vicious inflation and the slow burn is the much greater risk. And slow burn we did. And I said gold would end at 1350 for the year. It ended above a little bit above 1400. I was assuming they were going to slam it back down to 1350 at the end of the year. They didn't. I thought the central banks would hold the line at 25%. That was sort of the reason. If you looked at fundamental economics, there was a reason to believe we'd get a much larger price rise. I just didn't think they'd let it go above 25%. They held the line at 30. I was a little surprised to see them let it go that high, but sure enough, they did. Gold came in at just a tad above 29%. Obviously, silver doing much better, but silver had lagged tremendously. I had said that silver would have a great year, but it went way beyond my expectations. I said unemployment would rise and the economy would stay front and center. Sure enough, it did. So 2011, what's ahead? If 2009 was the year of the great vampire squid and 2010 was the year the road turned eastward, well, what will 2011 be? After much thinking and discussion, I'm naming 2011 Slow Burn on the Prairie. And let me explain why. The financial coup d'etat is over. The resources have left, whether they've gone to Asia or into space investment. And now we're faced with reinventing who and what we are. And we've seen the plan of what the leadership has in mind with a very centralized global control with very invasive technology and very powerful corporations and banks. I think most of us don't think it's a very, it's not a vision that excites our sense of excellence and our pride in being part of excellent civilization. It's basically an economy of force, and it's a vision of force that really doesn't call on human intelligence, and it doesn't have what the Chinese call the mandate of heaven. And so we need a new story, but we don't have a new story. We've just kind of coming to the realization that we've been left behind. It's a little like when I drove across the country in the 90s, I would come into a Super 8 motel at 3 o'clock in the morning, and there'd be somebody behind the counter reading Left Behind, and finally I thought, why has this book captured everybody's imagination? I read it, and sure enough, you know, I realized, well, you know, it's kind of smart. They realize they have been left behind. So we need a new story. We don't like the pro-centralization team vision. We're out on the prairie, and things are, you know, whether the weather is weird or the leadership appears to have sometimes lost their mind, you know, sort of the bad news is we're on our own. The good news is we're on our own. And I'm reminded of two quotes. One of my favorite is from Winston Churchill. He said, "We have not journeyed across the centuries, across the oceans, across the mountains, across the prairies, because we are made of sugar candy." One of the things, most of the people in the first world are horribly, horribly spoiled. If you go back and look at what our ancestors did 2, 3, 4 generations ago, whether they were on the prairies or came to the prairies, whether they were here or immigrants or came against their will in slave ships, what you will see if you go back and look at what your ancestors did three and four generations ago, what you realize is they didn't have insurance, they didn't have government benefits, they didn't have social safety nets, they didn't have any of these things, and they basically invented worlds. They invented communities, they built families, they built businesses, and you know, they had a good time doing it, often case. So if you look at what they've accomplished on the prairie, it's very inspiring in terms of what we can. And now, you know, they were out in the prairie. We have to contend with a slow burn, whether it's the debasement of the currency or all sorts of games around economic warfare. I'm a little bit reminded of Flip Wilson, a wonderful quote that I put up on the blog earlier this year. He said, "We came here on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now." My great ally, Thomas Hupp, sent me a wonderful email at the beginning of the new year. He said, you know, he says, the ship has left, has sailed, and we're all on it. So the charts are going vertical. We're in new territory, and we're going to reinvent our world. And so 2011 is a time when we haven't reached the tipping point in the 100 monkey story. We haven't gathered all the monkeys we need to bring about real change. But the good news is they're starting to gather, and that's a good feeling. So think about life on the prairie and gathering the other people for change. My prediction on the slow burn is the same this year, so that's why I'm calling it slow burn on the prairie. 70% chance of slow burn, 20 to 25% chance of another 2008 kind of scenario, 0 to 5% collapse. Again, I think we're going to be slow burn. The bond market, I think, is going to be flat. The bull market's over, but interest rates may be a tad higher. Don't expect skyrocketing interest rates. Don't expect skyrocketing hyperinflation, but expect lots of hot potato as the credit issues have to get worked out around the debt systems or in the sovereign governments. But remember that the debt system is a control system more than a financial system. Because of the debasement of the currency, tangibles in the stock market are all going to be up, but again, expect unprecedented volatility in both of them, and the stock market is going to be split. All stock markets are not equal, so young populations and growing places are going to be very, very different than aging. So expect a lot of spread in terms of both demographics and places. On volatility, don't be surprised to see gold and silver correct as much as 10 to 15% down, but end the year up another 20 to 25%. So my number for the end of the year on gold is going to be 1650, and I put silver at about 42. Heroes for 2010. And here, every Solari report, we pick a hero. There were many heroes to choose from. You know, it's pretty heartening to, as you watch the different stories of people who rise to the occasion in a time such as this. Winners are a tie between the people of Iceland. The Icelandic response to the financial crisis was absolutely transforming and heartening. It's an amazing story of great leadership, the kind of leadership we need. I used to have a deputy at HUD who used to say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new. One of the things the people of Iceland have done is instituted new laws to promote independent journalism and transparency. They are a beacon of light for all of us, and so I send my best wishes and blessings to the people of Iceland. The other group is the Chilean miners and people. The miners are alive as a result of leadership and teamwork, a refusal to give up hope, not only by the miners, but the political leadership and the general population. It was another extraordinary story of leadership, the kind of leadership we need. There's nothing more important when you're out on the prairie than leadership. You can't wait for the U.S. Marshal to show up, if they ever do. runner-up is John Stewart at the end of the year when Congress was not going to pass the health care benefits for the 9/11 responders, an absolute tragedy. John Stewart got the responders on a show and sure enough got the benefits engineered, a great example of what journalism can do. And John Stewart would say he wasn't a journalist, but it's the comedians who become the journalists. But they, all of them are an inspiration for us. And one of the things I've tried to do in my life is to focus more on being with and in and around great leadership, particularly in business and communities. And I have to say my life has benefited tremendously from it. And in 2011, I encourage you, think long and hard about what kind of leader you want to be and how you can get into cahoots with other leaders who are the kind of people that you want to succeed out on the prairie with. In closing, that's it for the wrap-up. Soleri Silver and Gold, we reopen on January 10th. Our very own Mr. David Lichty has gotten married to a beautiful bride, and he's headed to New York to practice law. Paul Ferguson and I wish him well and look forward to helping you at Soleri Silver and Gold. We're going through a fundamental shift into tangibles, as I've described in this wrap-up. You need to make sure you're repositioned. We would love to help you do that, so give us a call. I'm looking forward to being with you next week with Franklin Sanders. We're going to have our 2011 outlook just for precious metals. We want to drill down and spend a whole Soleri report just on our outlook for precious metals. And we're also going to do a special segment on how to manage volatility, how to live with volatility, what that means. And finally, we're going to talk about the next date in our top 10 dates in the history of gold and silver. We're going to address Nixon ending of the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s. Then the following week, we've got Scott Rasmussen of Rasmussen Reports. He's the top independent pollster in the U.S. on what Americans are thinking and feeling. So until then, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Indeed, one of the defining characteristics of those, if you look back to our ancestors who succeeded out on the prairie, is they conspired to build families and communities to last. We can too. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.